So welcome back to the Deep Dive. And usually when we talk about digital technology with you, the listener, there is this, I guess, this expectation of weightlessness.
Right, yeah, like it doesn't actually exist in the physical world.
Exactly. You type a prompt into your browser, the screen blinks, and then boom, the machine hands you a perfectly formatted essay or like a fully generated video.
Yeah, it feels like magic.
It really does. It feels like pure thought just floating in this abstract space that we literally call the cloud.
Which is such a brilliant marketing term, honestly. We like things to be frictionless. We want the result without seeing the factory floor, you know? The whole interface is basically designed to hide the mechanics from you.
But today, we're stripping away that magic trick. We're going to pull back the curtain on this fascinating 2026 academic white paper by Dr. Bechara Saley.
Right, the hidden life ground of artificial intelligence.
That's the one. Because we all experience AI as this seemingly infinite, invisible resource, but Dr. Saheeli argues that AI actually has a physical
A
body.
very demanding physical body.
And that body is heavily grounded in local electricity grids, municipal water systems, vast tracts of land, and surprisingly, a ton of human labor.
Yeah, the central question the paper forces us to confront, and what you should really keep in mind today, is whether artificial intelligence actually expands our human life capacity within planetary ecological limits, or if it simply converts our physical life support systems into what the author terms symbolic excess.
Symbolic excess. I love that phrasing.
It really challenges the whole premise that digital output is inherently decoupled from physical extraction.
So let's actually break this down. Let's unpack this. Dr. Saheeli frames AI as having a hidden metabolism.
Right, metabolism isn't just a metaphor here.
Yeah, he breaks this down into a nine-stage life cycle, but I want to avoid just, reading a table of contents to you. Let's
Yeah.
actually trace the physical chain reaction.
Trace it from the very beginning.
Exactly. Because before I even sit down at my computer to type a prompt, an immense amount of physical infrastructure has to be built, right? We are talking about model production and the literal hardware.
Building the brain of the AI, so to speak. Because a foundational AI model isn't just a clever mathematical equation floating in space.
Right, it lives on servers.
It's the result of highly specialized hardware, specifically graphics processing units, or GPUs, and tensor cores.
And we should probably explain why AI requires this specific hardware because it's different from regular computing, right?
Completely different. Traditional cloud computing uses central processing units, or CPUs, which process tasks sequentially, like one step after another.
Okay, so very linear.
Exactly. But AI, and particularly neural networks, they require parallel processing. The system has to calculate millions of probabilities simultaneously just to determine the relationships between words or pixels.
And parallel processing requires a very specific type of microchip, which I guess leads us straight into the physical reality of the supply chain.
Right. To build those chips, you don't just need silicon. You need copper, you need lithium, cobalt, and all these rare earth metals.
And mining those is not a clean process.
Oh, it's an intensely physical, disruptive process. It disrupts land, it requires heavy diesel machinery, and it often involves highly toxic chemical processing just to separate the rare earths from the surrounding ore.
And then once it's extracted.
Then these materials are shipped all over the globe to fabrication plants. And these plants require hyper-sterile environments,
Like clean rooms.
extreme clean rooms, and immense amounts of stable electricity just to etch the microscopic transistors onto the silicon wafers.
Okay, so we've mined the earth, we've built these hyper-specialized chips, and now we have to assemble them into server racks, which brings us to the deployment infrastructure.
The data centers.
The data centers, yeah. And this is where the thermodynamics really start to matter, right?
Thermodynamics is basically the governing law of artificial intelligence. Well, when you run millions of calculations a second on these parallel processors, that electrical resistance generates heat, a lot of heat.
Right, like when your laptop gets hot, but scaled up.
Scaled up exponentially. A traditional server rack in a standard cloud data center might draw, say, 5 to 10 kilowatts of power. But a high-density AI server rack, that can draw 40 to 100 kilowatts.
Wait, seriously, that's massive.
Yeah, they are essentially miniature industrial furnaces just stacked on top of one another inside a giant warehouse.
Which means you have to cool them down, otherwise the chips just literally melt.
Exactly.
But I always assumed data centers just used massive air conditioning units, like, you know, a heavy-duty version of what we have in our houses.
That's how older ones worked, yeah.
Yeah.
But standard air conditioning cannot scale to the thermal density of modern AI workloads.
It would just use too much power.
It would require an absurd amount of electricity. So engineers frequently use what's called evaporative cooling.
Okay, how does that work?
Basically, hot air from the servers is passed over these water-soaked media pads. And as the water absorbs the heat, it evaporates, which naturally lowers the temperature of the air.
Like sweating, kind of.
Very much like sweating. It's highly effective, but it means the facility needs a continuous, uninterrupted flow of millions of gallons of fresh water.
Millions of gallons. And the paper points out that this can't just be like ocean water or recycled gray water, right?
In many systems, no, it can't be.
Why not?
To prevent mineral scale and bacteria from building up on the cooling equipment, and these are highly sensitive electronics, right? The facility often requires potable water.
Potable water, so like drinking water.
The exact same treated drinkable water that flows into local municipal supplies.
So the data center is literally tapped directly into the local town's drinking supply.
Yes.
Wow. That really moves the whole metabolism concept from this abstract idea of cooling into direct ecological competition with people.
It's direct competition for a life-sustaining resource.
So we have the hardware, the electricity, the water, the land to house all these massive warehouses. But there's another hidden component in the paper that really surprised me.
Labor.
Yes, labor. The paper lists labor as a critical part of this physical metabolism. But wait, isn't AI essentially a labor-saving automation tool? Like, isn't the point that it does the work for us?
That is a very common misconception. We tend to view AI as this autonomous, self-learning entity that just figures things out.
Right, like an alien intelligence.
But to make the machine appear autonomous, you actually need an invisible army of human workers.
Invisible army, what are they doing?
It's a process called RLHF, reinforcement learning from human feedback.
Okay.
Because the model might be able to string words together and generate text, but it doesn't intuitively know what is helpful, what's accurate, or what is violently toxic.
Oh, so human beings have to manually sit there and teach it the difference.
Yes, thousands of data labelers and content moderators. And they're frequently located in regions with lower labor costs, right? They spend their days reading generated text, categorizing images, and flagging toxic content just to refine the model's behavioral guardrails.
So it's not learning on its own.
Not really. The AI is mimicking patterns based on millions of hours of human feedback. The labor isn't actually eliminated, it's just reorganized, pushed way down the supply chain, and hidden behind this clean chat interface.
Wow. Okay, so we have all these inputs, and eventually all this physical hardware is going to reach the end of its life cycle, right? Which leads us to the final stage of the metabolism, e-waste.
Yeah, and the competitive pressure to release the next generation of AI models forces incredibly rapid hardware turnover.
How rapid?
An AI chip might be functionally obsolete in 3 to 5 years.
3 to 5 years. And then what? It doesn't just evaporate into the cloud.
No, it ends up in global waste streams. And because of
Well,
what's inside them, they often end up leaching heavy metals into the ecological sink.
so when you look at the entire chain from the mine to the clean room to the water-cooled data center to the hidden human labor and finally to the landfill, you realize that typing a simple AI prompt is pulling a thread connected to this massive planetary metabolism.
Exactly. It's an expansive, sprawling physical footprint.
Okay, so now that we understand the actual mechanics of this body, we need to look at its scale. Because Dr. Sakili's paper draws heavily on this 2025 foundational report from the UN.
The United Nations University Institute for Water, Environment, and Health, UNU and WEH.
Right, let's look at their numbers because they are staggering. According to the UN data, data centers consumed roughly 448 terawatt hours of electricity globally in 2025.
And they project that to hit approximately 945 terawatt hours by 2030.
945. That is approaching 3% of the entire projected global electricity demand, just for data centers.
Yeah. To put that into perspective for your 945 terawatt hours is significantly more electricity than many entire industrialized nations use in a year.
That is, I mean, that's hard to even wrap your head around.
And what's most revealing in the UN report is the actual composition of that energy use. In 2025, AI workloads accounted for roughly 20% of total data center energy.
Okay, 20%.
But by 2030, that specific AI slice is projected to reach 40%.
So the broader digital infrastructure isn't just passively hosting AI anymore. AI is structurally taking it over.
It's becoming the dominant workload, yeah.
But the UN report does something interesting. Their methodology shifts the conversation away from just looking at electricity and carbon. They insist that evaluating AI requires a tripart lens.
Right, carbon, water, and land.
Why is it dangerous to look at this solely through a carbon lens? I mean, isn't reducing carbon emissions a good thing?
It is. But if you only look at carbon, you run into a phenomenon known as burden shifting.
Burden shifting. Let's unpack that.
So if a technology company optimizes its infrastructure for a single metric, let's say zero carbon emissions, they can go to the press and claim complete sustainability.
Right, we're carbon neutral.
Exactly. But they might be inadvertently devastating another ecological pillar to achieve that.
It's like, here's where it gets really interesting. It's like bragging about being on a low-carb diet, right? But you're eating 10,000 calories of pure fat every day. You fixed one metric, but your overall system is still crashing.
That is exactly how burden shifting operates in the real world. Think about it. A tech firm might build a massive new AI data center in a desert region.
Okay.
And they power it entirely with a brand new giant solar farm.
Yeah.
So on paper, the carbon footprint is zero. The carbon end of the balloon is squeezed tight.
Sounds great so far.
But solar arrays require sweeping tracts of land, which disrupts the local ecosystems. And furthermore, because the data center is in a desert environment, those evaporative cooling systems we talked about.
Oh, right. The water pads.
They require draining vast amounts of water from a local, often fragile, aquifer. So a low-carbon AI system is not automatically a low-water or low-land AI system.
You're just shifting the destruction from the atmosphere to the groundwater.
Okay,
so we know the infrastructure is massive. We know it draws heavily on water and land. But when is all this energy actually being consumed? Because I hear a lot of debates about how much power it takes to build an AI, but not so much about what happens after it's built.
And that brings us to a really fundamental engineering distinction that the paper highlights. The difference between model training and model inference.
Training versus inference. Let's start with training.
So model training is the initial construction phase. You take vast, unimaginable amounts of unstructured data and you feed it through the neural network.
Right, making it read the whole internet.
Basically, yeah. And the algorithms use an incredibly intensive computational process called backpropagation. They're constantly adjusting billions or even trillions of internal parameters, which are called weights, until the model can accurately predict patterns.
And the paper notes some specific numbers here. Training GPT-3 took an estimated 1.3 gigawatt hours of electricity.
Right.
But then training a later model, like GPT-4, took an estimated 50 to 70 gigawatt hours.
It's an exponential leap in energy concentration. Just massive.
Yeah.
But here's the thing. Training is an episodic, highly visible event. It happens in one place over a set period of weeks or months, and it's entirely under the control of the developers.
Dr. Sarah Lee refers to it as a spectacle.
Spectacle, exactly. It's a big, showy event. But once the model is trained and deployed to the public, that's when we enter the phase of model inference.
Inference being the actual everyday use by you and me. Like every time I type a prompt, the model runs a forward pass through its network to generate a response. That's inference.
Correct. And here is the crucial metric that people miss. Inference accounts for 80 to 90% of the total lifecycle energy use of an AI system.
Wait, really? 80 to 90%?
Yeah.
I would have assumed the heavy lifting was all done in the lab during the training phase.
Well, the individual energy cost of a single inference, like just generating one paragraph of text, is minuscule compared to the whole training run.
Okay, that makes sense.
But you have to multiply that single inference by billions of daily users.
Mm.
And it's integrated into search engines, into email clients, into basic software suites. It's running 24 hours a day, 365 days a year.
So training scales by the size of the data set, but inference scales by the size of the human population using it.
Exactly. It becomes completely normalized. The energy draw just becomes part of the invisible background hum of society.
But not all inference is the same, is it? The paper introduces this concept called symbolic escalation, which tracks the gradient of computational intensity depending on what you're asking the AI to do.
Right. The physical cost of inference scales dramatically with the complexity of the media you are generating.
Okay, so walk me through this gradient.
At the low end of the gradient, you have basic classification tasks, like an algorithm sorting your email into the spam folder. Very low energy.
Makes sense.
Moving up, you have short text generation, like autocomplete. then long-form text synthesis, like writing essays.
And then there is a sharp spike, right, when you cross into visual media.
A very sharp spike. Image generation requires substantially more computation than text. You're mapping pixels instead of just words.
And at the very peak?
At the peak of the escalation curve is high-fidelity video generation.
Wow.
Generating just a few seconds of synthetic video requires processing millions of pixels across multiple frames while maintaining temporal consistency so it doesn't look like a glitchy mess. The thermal and electrical cost for that is immense.
Which introduces a really compelling idea from the paper, the idea of the minimum sufficient symbolic form.
I really like this concept.
It's the idea that we should match the computational tool to the practical task at hand.
Right.
Like if I need to buy a carton of milk from the corner store two blocks away, I should walk, maybe take a bicycle.
Sure.
Using an AI video generator to answer a basic factual search query is like using a massive diesel-guzzling dump truck to go get that milk.
That's a great analogy.
It technically accomplishes the task, right? I got the milk. But it is a massive, unjustifiable overexpenditure of physical resources for what I actually needed.
It's a profound mismatch of proportion. And the structural issue we're facing is that technology platforms are currently designing their user interfaces to default to the dump truck.
What do you mean?
Well, if a search engine utilizes a massive generative model to answer a really simple navigational query, something where a standard static web link would have been perfectly sufficient, the platform normalizes that heavy ecological cost.
Just to show off.
Essentially, yes. Simply to demonstrate its technological capabilities and keep you on their platform.
Okay, let's unpack this a bit more. Because if we are all driving these computational dump trucks around all day, who is breathing in the exhaust?
That's the million-dollar question.
Because when I receive an AI-generated video on my laptop, my machine doesn't get hot, I don't see any smoke, the impact feels entirely disconnected from my action.
And that spatial separation is the core of what the paper calls the geography of injustice.
The geography of injustice?
Yeah. The user experiences the clean, frictionless output, while the physical burden of that output is displaced geographically, usually to somewhere less visible.
The paper actually outlines seven distinct geographical burdens. Let's explore how these manifest in the real world, because it's pretty sobering.
It is. So the first burden is grid competition.
Okay, we touched on this a bit.
Right. When a hyperscale data center connects to a regional power grid, its massive continuous demand for electricity can compete directly with the needs of local residents, hospitals, and schools.
And that drives up prices.
It can drive up local energy prices, and it can severely strain grid stability, leading to blackouts.
Wow. Okay, what's the second burden?
Second is water stress. Like we discussed with evaporative cooling, data centers can heavily tax local aquifers. And this is especially devastating in regions that are already experiencing climate-driven drought.
They're literally drinking the town's water. Okay, third is land transformation, right?
Yes, the sheer physical footprint. The infrastructure devours natural habitats and prime agricultural spaces just to build these sprawling warehouse campuses.
And fourth is mineral extraction.
Right. The environmental degradation of mining, the toxic runoff, the destroyed landscapes, all that occurs in distant regions, far away from the corporate headquarters where these chips are actually designed.
Out of sight, out of mind. Fifth, the paper lists labor invisibility, which we talked about with RLHF.
Exactly. The precarious, often poorly compensated work of data labeling is outsourced to economies with weaker labor protections. The psychological toll of viewing toxic content is carried by workers hidden from the end user.
Sixth is e-waste.
Right. When the hardware is obsolete in 3 years, it is frequently shipped off to developing nations, creating these toxic afterlives in communities that completely lack the infrastructure to safely recycle heavy metals.
And the seventh and final burden is digital dependency.
This one is more structural. Less powerful regions become entirely reliant on tech monopolies, usually headquartered in a totally different nation, for their basic digital infrastructure.
So they lose their own technological sovereignty.
Precisely. They have to play by the rules of a foreign corporation just to participate in the modern economy.
So when you look at all seven burdens together, a very clear, very uncomfortable pattern emerges.
Very clear.
The benefits of AI, you know, the everyday convenience, the substantial corporate profits, the geopolitical advantages, all of that flows upward. It flows to the platform owners, the investors, and the end users in affluent areas.
Right.
But the physical burdens, they are pushed downward onto communities that often lack the political leverage to say no.
Dr. Sarhili defines this exact dynamic as sacrifice zone AI.
Sacrifice zone AI, that's a heavy term.
It is, but it's accurate. It's a structural reality where a massive corporation can announce global sustainability targets, they can brand themselves as green, while at the local material level, specific vulnerable communities are asked to subsidize that corporate greenwashing.
By sacrificing their own resources.
Exactly. They are literally asked to subsidize the creation of synthetic text and images with their own municipal water, their own land, and their own local grid capacity.
Think about the device you are listening to this deep dive on right now. Just consider it. Where was the copper inside it mined? Where is the server hosting this audio file physically located? Where will the battery eventually end up?
Their physical life support is sacrificed to power someone else's symbolic production.
And here's what I don't get. If this system is so resource heavy, and if it relies on creating these local sacrifice zones, why is it growing so exponentially?
Right.
Because the tech industry often argues that they are simply meeting consumer demand, right? Like, people want AI, so we are just building it for them.
The paper dedicates an entire section to deconstructing that exact specific narrative.
Oh, really?
Yeah. The section is called The Political Economy of Manufactured Demand. And the core argument here is that the current scale of AI demand is not a natural expression of human curiosity.
It's not just people wanting to play with chatbots.
No. It is structurally manufactured by the industry itself.
Okay, how so? Because Dr. Sangli lists 10 drivers of this manufactured demand. Let's group these to really understand the ecosystem here. The first group seems to be about how the software is basically forced onto the user. Platform defaulting and search integration.
Right, and this is perhaps the most immediate driver we all experience.
Yeah, I see it everywhere now.
When an email provider updates its software to automatically generate 3 suggested AI replies for every single message you receive, it fundamentally transforms a low-energy digital habit into a continuous infrastructure load.
Without me even asking for it.
Exactly. The user didn't actively request AI assistance to reply to an email from their mom. The platform just defaulted to it.
Then you have the financial and competitive pressures. The paper lists venture capital, cloud concentration, institutional imitation, and the frontier arms race.
This is where the money drives the scale. The financial markets basically demand exponential growth from these companies.
So they have to keep building.
They are locked in a race to build the largest, most capable models. And it's not necessarily because there is a defined organic public need for a model that big.
Right.
It's out of fear of losing market dominance. It's a preemptive arms race. They are building vast server farms primarily to prove to investors that they have the compute capacity to outpace their rivals.
It's just a flex.
A very expensive, resource-intensive flex.
And the final drivers listed are geopolitical competition and public subsidies.
Right, at the nation-state level. Governments increasingly view advanced AI as a matter of national security and economic supremacy.
So they get involved directly.
Yes. They subsidize massive infrastructure buildouts, which further accelerates the expansion completely, regardless of the immediate ecological cost. It becomes a matter of national pride and defense.
But wait, let me push back a little here. Surely, amidst all this massive expansion, the hardware is becoming more efficient, right? Like,
yeah.
Every year, chips get better. If the chips use less power per calculation, doesn't that inherently reduce the environmental impact?
Logically, you would think so. But this is where we encounter the rebound effect.
The rebound effect.
Specifically something called the Jevons paradox.
Okay, I've heard of this. Who was Jevons?
William Stanley Jevons was a 19th century economist. And he observed this highly counterintuitive phenomenon with coal during the Industrial Revolution.
What happened?
Well, when steam engines became vastly more efficient, people naturally assumed that overall coal consumption would drop. Because you needed less coal to do the same amount of work.
Right, that makes sense. You need less fuel, you burn less fuel.
But instead, total coal consumption absolutely skyrocketed.
But why?
Because the increased efficiency made the steam engine cheaper and more profitable to operate. So industries didn't just use their existing engines less, they built vastly more of them. And they found entirely new ways to use them in factories and trains that weren't economically viable before.
Ah, I see. So the efficiency actually unlocked more demand.
Precisely. And the exact same principle applies to computational efficiency today.
So when a new generation of AI chips operates more efficiently,
it lowers the cost of processing a single token of data.
Right.
But the technology company doesn't simply maintain their current level of output and just bank the energy savings.
They reinvest it.
They use that efficiency gain to build a data center 10 times the size. They train models with 100 times more parameters. And they integrate AI into every possible software application, even the trivial ones.
So the increase in total widespread usage vastly outpaces whatever initial energy was saved by the efficiency gain.
Exactly. Efficiency without a defined concept of sufficiency simply leads to acceleration.
Wait, say that again? Efficiency without sufficiency.
Yeah. If you don't define what enough looks like, what is sufficient, making a process more efficient just allows the system to consume resources at a much faster rate.
Which brings us to the conceptual heart of the paper. With all these massive forces pushing AI onto us, how does a society actually evaluate what role this technology is playing?
And that's where Dr. Saley provides a diagnostic matrix.
I found this part fascinating. He outlines five interpretive roles that AI can assume in a society: the tool, the oracle, the idol, the enclosure, and the commons.
Right. It's a progression.
Let's test that framework, starting with role number one, AI as a tool. I assume this represents the system functioning within healthy, normal boundaries.
Yes. In this role as a tool, AI is bounded, it's task appropriate, and most importantly, it is subordinate to human life.
So we are using it, it's not using us.
Exactly. It's designed to solve specific material problems. For example, using a machine learning algorithm to optimize the aerodynamics of wind turbine blades.
Okay, highly specific.
Or using pattern recognition to assist meteorologists in tracking severe weather patterns. The technology serves physical life capacity, and it is utilized only when necessary.
But the matrix suggests there is a natural, almost inevitable drift. We start with the tool, but we easily slip into role number two, the oracle.
The transition to the oracle occurs when a society begins to treat the machine's output as inherently superior to situated human judgment.
Like, we trust the machine more than ourselves.
Right. Because generative AI produces language with such extreme fluency and speed, it creates a very compelling illusion of wisdom.
It sounds confident, so we assume it's right.
Exactly. We stop using the machine to assist our critical thinking, and we begin deferring to the algorithm to make actual decisions for us.
And once we defer to it, we risk descending into role number three, the idol. Now, I have to admit, when I first read the paper, the term idol felt somewhat dramatic for describing, you know, data centers and enterprise software.
It does sound a bit theological, sure. But Dr. C. Healy is using it in a strictly operational, anthropological sense.
How so?
Historically, an idol is defined by its demand for sacrifice. An idol requires its followers to surrender something vital and real to appease a symbolic representation.
Something real for something symbolic.
Yes. So if a society drains a functioning vital water reservoir just to cool a data center whose primary output is generating automated marketing texts and synthetic images, that society is literally sacrificing its physical life support systems to expand a machine. The real is sacrificed for the symbolic. That is the functional definition of idolatry.
When you lay out the physical trade-offs, like that local drinking water for synthetic marketing content, the term fits perfectly. It is a material sacrifice.
It is. And that structural sacrifice naturally leads to the fourth role, the enclosure.
The enclosure, what does that mean in this context?
This happens when the infrastructure required to run these massive models captures public resources, the water, the grid capacity, the land, and walls them off under the control of a few private technology monopolies.
So public resources become privatized for AI.
Exactly. The commons is enclosed for private centralized profit.
Which brings us to the fifth and final role, and this is the alternative the paper advocates for, right? The commons.
The commons represents a state of shared stewardship.
What does that look like?
It envisions an AI ecosystem governed not by the imperative for monopolistic growth, but by a mandate to expand shared life capacity within strict ecological limits.
So it's democratic.
Yes. In a commons model, the local community actually has a voice in determining what infrastructure is built, how it is powered, and who ultimately benefits from its output.
But how do we get there? I mean, moving from enclosure to a commons requires an immense shift in how we regulate technology.
It's a paradigm shift, definitely.
The paper outlines a 10-part governance cycle designed to shift the paradigm away from basic legal compliance and toward active ecological stewardship.
And this cycle includes concepts like purpose, transparency, and life cycle responsibility.
But there are a few components that stood out to me as particularly structural. The first is sufficiency.
Right, which ties back to the Jevons paradox.
Exactly. Governance cannot merely ask, can we run this AI model more efficiently?
Because that just leads to more usage.
Right. It must ask the foundational question of sufficiency. Is this computational task actually worth doing, given the physical cost?
It demands proportionality.
Another concept that I thought was brilliant was public interest compute.
Yes, that's a crucial one.
The idea that a certain percentage of physical data center capacity should be legally reserved for public interest research, like climate modeling or medical research, rather than being entirely dedicated to commercial software.
It treats compute as a public utility.
And perhaps the most radical component of this governance cycle is the insistence on the power of refusal.
Dr. Sadly is very firm on this. He argues that if a community or a nation cannot say no to a harmful technological system,
like if turning it off would cause immediate economic collapse.
Exactly. If you can't turn it off, then that community is not actually governing the technology. They are completely dependent upon it.
They're trapped.
True governance requires the structural ability to withdraw consent and dismantle systems that exceed ecological boundaries.
So to understand the immediate high-stakes reality of this whole governance framework, the paper presents a specific geographic test case, small island developing states, or SIDs.
Specifically focusing on the Caribbean.
Right. Why are small islands the ideal test case for analyzing AI's physical metabolism? Why not a big city?
Because small island developing states operate on undeniable immediate physical constraints. They do not have the luxury of spatial separation that continents have.
Everything is right there.
Right. Their energy grids are often fragile microgrids, heavily reliant on really expensive imported fossil fuels. They have strictly limited freshwater aquifers.
You can't just pipe water in from another state.
Exactly. They have absolute physical boundaries on land use,
mm-hmm.
and they sit on the absolute front lines of climate vulnerability with hurricanes and sea level rise.
So if a tech company proposes building a hyperscale data center in, say, a vast continental landscape, the burden shifting might be hidden for years. You might not notice the aquifer dropping right away.
But on a small island, the impact is instantaneous.
There's nowhere to hide it.
Exactly. The paper outlines two potential futures for these islands. The first is the AI dependency trap.
Which is the enclosure model.
Right. In this scenario, the island nation simply imports the massive models built by foreign monopolies.
Mm.
The data center lands on the island, and immediately its immense thermal and electrical load directly competes with the local infrastructure.
It's fighting the locals for resources.
A facility processing global search queries is suddenly competing with a local hospital for grid stability and water pressure. The island essentially trades its physical resilience just for digital access.
And the alternative.
The alternative is the Caribbean AI Commons.
And how does that function?
In a commons model, the island nation governs the technology proportionally. They refuse the hyperscale data centers.
They use the power of refusal.
Yes, but they heavily utilize specialized smaller AI models designed for vital, life-serving tasks.
Tools, not idols.
Exactly. They deploy bounded machine learning to predict localized hurricane paths, monitor the health of vital coral reef ecosystems, optimize their desalination plants to save water, and manage complex renewable microgrids.
So the compute actually serves the physical reality of the island.
They retain technological sovereignty, ensuring the compute serves the island rather than the island serving the global compute.
I think this is where the paper connects most deeply with you, the listener, because even if you don't live on an island in the Caribbean, the island acts as a planetary microcosm.
It really does.
The Earth itself is a closed system with absolute physical boundaries. If an AI infrastructure model fails catastrophically on a small island because it exhausts the available water and power, that exact same infrastructural model will eventually fail globally.
The physics are completely identical. Only the timeline is extended.
The island is the planet.
It is a stark reminder that ecological limits are not theoretical guidelines. They are physical realities that computation simply cannot bypass.
So how do we apply this philosophy to our daily routines? For the listener sitting at their desk right now, or maybe commuting to work or managing a team, how do we step out of the illusion of the weightless cloud?
Dr. Sadly concludes with a very practical framework called the Life Coherent AI Use Protocol.
Life coherent. I like that.
It is essentially a 10-question audit that you can run before deploying or engaging with any AI system.
What kind of questions?
It forces the user to evaluate need, purpose, proportionality, the physical footprint, and whether the task fosters dependency or knowledge integrity.
Okay, so running through this protocol leads to four possible decisions regarding the technology, right?
Right. You either proceed with limits, redesign the system, or refuse and withdraw entirely.
Let's apply this to a mundane, everyday scenario for the listener. Imagine you are at work and you are about to instruct a generative AI to draft a comprehensive 20-page market analysis report based on just a few bullet points.
Okay, common scenario. So before you hit enter, the protocol asks you to pause and evaluate proportionality.
Right. Is this the dump truck?
Exactly. Is a 20-page synthetic document genuinely necessary for the task? Who is going to read it?
Probably another AI.
Often, yes. What is the physical computational footprint of generating that sheer volume of text? And more importantly, regarding knowledge integrity. Are you substituting the machine's synthetic fluency for your own actual comprehension of the market dynamics?
Wow. Are you just letting it sound smart so you don't have to think?
Right. Could you achieve a better, more grounded result using traditional research and your own critical thinking?
It really requires actively breaking the habit of the default. I challenge everyone listening to run a proportionality audit on your own digital habits this week.
That's a great exercise.
The next time you open an AI interface, just ask yourself, am I using the smallest, most adequate tool for this task? Am I driving a dump truck to get milk?
And usually you don't need the dump truck.
Right. If you just need a basic spell check or a factual query, downgrade the computational modality. Don't trigger a massive multimodal neural network when a simple algorithm will suffice.
It is entirely about reclaiming agency. When you choose the proportionate tool, you are actively participating in reducing the unnecessary ecological burden on the exact physical systems that sustain us.
We started this deep dive looking at a seemingly magical weightless interface.
The cloud.
Right, the cloud. But by tracing the hidden metabolism, we followed the prompt from your keyboard down into the mineral mines, through the parallel processors, into the water-cooled data centers, and out into the global waste streams.
We explored the trap of symbolic escalation, where just vast amounts of energy are expended to produce synthetic media of diminishing actual value.
And we confronted the vital necessity of transitioning our technological frameworks from these extractive isles toward a life-coherent commons.
Grounded in real sufficiency and stewardship.
Every prompt you type, every query you run has a physical anchor in the real breathing world.
There is one final concept from the paper to consider, and it's something to really mull over.
What's that?
We name this technology artificial intelligence. But observe what true intelligence means in the natural world.
Okay.
The ultimate marker of biological intelligence is the capacity of an organism to adapt to its environment without destroying the finite resources required for its own survival.
Right. Survival of the fittest means living in balance.
Exactly. So if our artificial systems are structurally designed to endlessly consume the land, water, and energy required to sustain human life.
Just how intelligent are they, really?
Excited.
That is the ultimate question we have to answer. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive into the physical reality behind the screen. We will see you next time.